exited planet Earth. But now that wasn't good enough. My men didn't see themselves as Rakondos, just one of four battalions. My guys were hardcore Rakondos, which made all the difference in the world. So the search began for a new, unique way of letting Charlie know. Soon one of our sergeants came up with the ultimate of identifiers, a branding iron that read Hardcore. Talk about dehumanization of the enemy. Still, it was a novel idea, and damned potent psychology. Logistically, though, the minute the sergeant presented the device to me, I knew we would never use it. Not only would someone have to lug the thing, but there was the added problem of how we would heat it up. So we went back to flipping Rakondo cards. But we did keep the branding iron around for its value as representative battlefield humor. At night at FSB Danger, I often walked the berm and talked to the troops on guard duty, along with some of the snipers and HQ personnel. Guard was pulled by whichever rifle company was in from the field resting up and drying out, so these late-night chats gave me the chance to get to know the individual men, and vice versa, the personalities of the individual outfits, and an up-to-date measure of the overall proficiency, discipline, and spirit of the battalion. One evening, just at dusk as I made my rounds, I must have been somewhat preoccupied because one of the sniper sergeants stopped me. "Why do you look so sad, sir?" he asked. "Have we had a low body count today?" "Yeah," I replied, playing along. "Six dicks. That's it, all day." "Well, how about if I get you three more, sir?" he asked, and leaning against the sandbag top of the berm, he aimed his powerful sniper rifle at three Arvin soldiers guarding a bridge about 400 meters away. "That'll make it nine." I knocked the barrel of the weapon up in the air as I saw the sergeant taking the slack up on the trigger. "Hold it, man," I said. "They're South Vietnamese." "A gook's a gook," the sergeant replied, shrugging. "Look, we'll get some dicks tonight, okay? Toller will bring 'em in, so just cool it." "Yes, sir." "A gook's a gook," he said, otherwise known in the 9th Division as the mere gook rule. I couldn't even chew the guy's ass. He was wrong, but I knew why he thought he was right, and I knew he was not alone in his feelings. Most everybody in the hardcore hated Arvin, just as most everyone in the 1st of the 101st had hated Arvin, and for the same reasons. In particular, the battalion from Arvin's 7th Infantry Division that shared our AO. Day after day, these Viet troops went out and never found the Viet Cong. Yet if we followed in their tracks, we had to fight it out every step of the way. The Arvin unit had reached a you-don't-shoot-us-we-don't-shoot-you accommodation with the enemy. If they saw a contact brewing, they just walked around it. My guys saw this, and when they saw the medevac ships carrying away their buddies who'd been wounded or killed while Arvin sat back and let us fight their war, it bred tremendous resentment. The kind of resentment that made a gook a gook. Arvin's stock didn't go up much higher when a civilian bus was mistakenly blown up by a VC mine, and one Arvin soldier, instead of helping the docs patch up his countrymen, stole the bandages. The civilian population also played a role in outraging the troops. In the bus incident, MPs had to fire shots in the air to keep the unhurt civilians from robbing the wounded, and confounding the entire U.S. effort, the latter something the American draftee soldier found incomprehensible since we were there to help them. Just one example was the 1st Brigade truck driver bringing supplies to us at Danger who got into a hassle on the road with the Jeep driven by a South Vietnamese troop. The Viet got so pissed off that he hopped out of his vehicle, walked right up to the truck driver, pulled out his pistol, and shot the driver dead as a doornail. At Danger itself, I allowed no Viet inside, civilian or military, regardless of rank. I didn't trust a single one of them not to be a potential VC spy or collaborator, and the fact that not once while we were there was FSB Danger attacked by enemy infantry or sappers proved the validity of the no Viet rule. I did let one civilian set himself up as the battalion barber near the front gate. He was good at his job and very punctual, and I always thought it was just a bit of paranoia on my part that I felt a little queasy when, after he'd cut my hair, he pulled out a flashing straight-edged razor to apply the finishing touches, Then one day he did not show up for work. The next night he was recognized among a pile of VC killed in a hardcore ambush. My throat tingled for a week. There were just so many incidents, seemingly hundreds of them, that involved civilian VC sympathizers. A particularly bad one in the 4th of the 39th occurred before I arrived, when three VC sympathizers in the form of teenage girls selling Coca-Cola were responsible for an ambush that led to serious casualties. In the words of Dan Evans, DSC-winning medic, for his outstanding performance during the battle company fiasco, who made regular medical civic action program MedCap visits to the villages as part of the U.S. Win the Hearts and Minds campaign, "Most of the time I enjoyed helping the people, but on days like that, I just felt like shooting them all. It really was a wonder there were not more Melis." I always found the mere gook rule very ironic, because whatever one thought of Arvin or of the South Vietnamese, the one thing I never would have accused the Viet Cong of being, and certainly not the main force VC, were mere gooks. On the contrary, Charlie was a most worthy opponent, and my own run-ins with him in the Delta only increased my respect for him. In the Delta, the VC generally hid all day to avoid our air surveillance and ground operations, and moved at dusk when the Americans traditionally weren't paying any attention, having stopped the war to eat dinner. So whenever I saw a chopper flying anywhere near danger at the end of the day, I flagged the pilot down for a quick overfly of our area in the hope of catching Charlie on the move. A lot of times I personally knew the pilots I asked to perform this extra duty, but even when I didn't, they were usually eager to oblige. It was well known that at danger we made a point of providing such volunteers with souvenirs, like captured Soviet weapons and other tokens of appreciation. One evening, a Brigade Loach came into danger flown by Warrant Officer Kenneth Carroll, one of the three pilots who flew for the brigade command regularly. Carroll was also one of the best pilots I'd ever known, and I loved to fly with him because whenever we got together, especially for these sundown hunting parties, something exciting seemed to happen. One reason for this was probably that Carroll had long before chosen to ignore the word younger pilots got before they were assigned to me, that whatever Hackworth says, they were not to fly me 1 inch below 1,500 feet. Another was that he had great courage and a sense of adventure. He was a good pal, and we made a great team. Carroll was even adept at flying his bird and simultaneously passing me M79 rounds when we got into our aerial end-of-the-day high noons. So on this particular evening, we took off and, as usual, started our visual recon of the outer strand of defensive wire that wrapped around danger. Carroll flew along about 20 feet off the ground as I checked the wire for cuts and the surrounding area for tracks, bent grass, or other signs indicating enemy presence. As we slowly circled, I saw nothing unusual at first. Then, to my complete surprise, I saw a guy in a green uniform studying our position, lying motionless near the last strand of wire but exposed thanks to the blast of air created by the chopper's rotor blades, which flattened the grass all around him. The first order of business was to find out if he was alone. I wanted this joker, but not bad enough to go down there and get Carol and myself blown away if there were more VC concealed in the high grass nearby. We hovered right over him, and I leveled my M79 so he knew the game was over. Then Carroll swung the chopper around and we did a quick but thorough search of the area. We found nothing, so we went back to the guy, landed, and I motioned with my weapon for him to get into the chopper. Not surprisingly, he didn't want to, so I got out and hoisted him into the back seat. I got in the front and poked my .38 Smith & Wesson through the cables between the front and back seats as a gentle reminder for the guy to stay put. I hoped he would. If I actually had to shoot him, the bullet would probably go right through his body and into the helicopter's transmission. Our plan was to take him back to the firebase, but as the chopper lifted off, the VC started to panic. It was obviously his first helicopter ride. In the rush of things, I hadn't buckled him in. Now he got up and started moving toward the door. We were up about 30 feet when he turned paratrooper and bailed out for his cherry jump. Fortunately, his chuteless self landed in a rice paddy, so he splashed rather than splattered on impact. We went down again and hovered over him as I motioned with my M79 for him to get back into the chopper. Once again, the VC refused to comply, but this time he grabbed a skid of the helicopter and began to shake it. And he shook it and shook it as if he really thought he could pull that bird out of the sky. Carol took the aircraft up 50 feet or so, but the guy hung on, still shaking and kicking up a storm. Carol took the bird down a little, and finally the VC fell off, only to make for a clump of bushes. I didn't know what was back there, and I wasn't going to let us get zapped as Don Schroeder had been the day his number came up. So Carol spun the chopper around between the VC and the bushes, and I shot the enemy soldier at point-blank range. It was getting dark, so we only had time for a very quick look around the area to find out what the guy had been up to. We soon discovered a number of wooden arrows on the ground pointing toward danger, which indicated to us that this VC had been a recon man with the mission of designating enemy weapons placements for an imminent attack on our firebase. Well, the attack was not so imminent anymore. Still, part of me didn't feel very good about killing that VC. Besides the fact that I'd rather have taken him back as a prisoner, our one-on-one encounter had somehow connected us, and I admired his guts. Unfortunately for him, my job was not to admire his guts. I knew, too, that if he could have wasted me instead, he'd have done so in a second. Sometime later, I got involved in a true David and Goliath drama with another even more gutsy VC, this time in broad daylight. Clark's company was in contact, and as I flew around the battle area, I saw a squad of VC hightailing it away from Clark's maneuvering forces. We followed them in my loach, only to discover an entire platoon, all looking good in pith helmets and neat uniforms, wearing load-bearing equipment and carrying AK-47s. It was one of the few times in the Delta I saw such a large group congregated together in daylight. I called for gunships and told Clark to move an ambush force in that direction. Meanwhile, to buy some time and to pin them down until the guns were on station and Clark made his move, we took the VC force under fire from the loach. Instantly, they scattered in every direction. All, that is, except one guy. Far from running away, every time we made a pass in the chopper, with my M79 blazing, this character would adopt the most perfect firing position Fort Benning ever dreamed of and shoot at us with his AK-47. On one knee, foot pointed toward the target and elbow under his weapon, this guy didn't even flinch as the chopper barreled at him. He was absolutely determined to get us, and his only problem was that I was just as determined as he was. But neither of us could manage a direct hit. The VC's slugs would come straight toward us, but then they seemed to hit the chopper's airstream and veer off at the last moment. On my end, I had to aim well in front of my opponent, using the wildest Kentucky windage imaginable, fire, and hope the airstream did the rest. And while the current did pick up the rounds and whip them around toward the guy, I could never get right on target, and no matter how close I did get, that VC just knelt there with his perfect bearing, firing his weapon at my chopper. Finally, a close hit on my part knocked him over, and after a moment, he took off. I didn't go after him, though. In fact, I wished him well. He was one courageous dude, probably the platoon commander of the unit I'd surprised, willing to take me on against near impossible odds so the rest of his platoon could escape. Perhaps the studliest Viet Cong of all that I encountered in Vietnam was the POW Gordy DeRoos's company took from the 261 Alpha Battalion the unit Dagger had battered and the Hard Corps had creamed in March. Despite being warned, he was a belligerent, mean little bastard who wouldn't give me a word more than his name, rank, and serial number. I wanted to talk to the guy. I'd been tracking the 261 Alpha as it rebuilt, both because there was little doubt they were the best in Dinh Thuong province, and I had a feeling they had plans for my battalion, and I thought I could get some information out of him. The S2 brought him to me just as I was eating at the end of a long day. The prisoner was a first lieutenant, a recon company commander in his late 20s, as defiant as I'd been warned, and even more banged up. The worst of his many battle scars was a leg that had a depression in it almost as deep and wide as my fist, A huge chunk of flesh had been blown out and never sewn up. It would have been a bad, bad wound even if medical attention had been available. Still, it had healed, and the guy had gone back to duty. This was one hardcore stud. He didn't want to talk to me, so I pointed to the old wound in his leg and through an interpreter asked if he had been hit. He said he had. "No hospital?" I asked. The prisoner shook his head almost scornfully. Then I showed him some of my wounds, which provoked the first bit of interest from the guy. He asked if they were from Vietnam. "No, no," I replied. "Before, Korea." "But this one," I continued, showing him my leg wound, "this one came from the VC here in the Delta." The wound was still red and raw, with big, vicious-looking stitch marks. "Maybe I did it," said the VC lieutenant, and he roared with a huge belly laugh. "Yeah, maybe you did," I replied. The warrior-to-warrior exchange broke the ice. It was a common bond that transcended patriotism or nationalism or causes. We laid down our flags and allowed ourselves to be friends. "Look," I said, "I know you're a hardcore son of a bitch. I know you'd like to grab a weapon or a hand grenade and blow us all up. Let's not do it that way. Let's be honorable. I know you're not going to tell me anything about your unit's disposition, because I know you wouldn't get anything from me about my outfit, so I'm not going to ask. But I'm a soldier. I admire your army's skill and your fighting spirit. So I want to know more about your army and your cause, why you're fighting, and why you believe as you do." For the next 3 nights, I'd come in from the field, and the prisoner and I would get together for chow and to talk. For all my talk of honor, in the back of my mind, I still hoped to break him down. I wanted to know where the 261 Alpha was and how it operated. But while we talked of many things, that subject was one he didn't say a word about. Meanwhile, the intelligence people at higher headquarters were starting to yell for him. I'd initially said I was hanging on to him because he was giving me hot stuff on the 261A. But after a couple of days, patience up above was wearing thin. "Look, my friend," I told the POW, "the word is I've got to evacuate you. Since I can't get any decent intelligence from you, I'm going to have to send you to my division HQ, where you will be interrogated further, and then they'll turn you over to the 7th Arvin Division. Now, the first thing Arvin is going to ask you is to Chu Hoi." Chu Hoi, or Open Arms, was a program designed to encourage VC defections. "If you do, they'll send you to a re-education center, and when you come out, you'll get a South Vietnamese uniform, a new M16, and be assigned to a South Vietnamese unit. Maybe you'll even come back here as a Tiger Scout so we can work together. So when you go to the 7th Division, tell them you're going to Chu Hoi." "I'll never do that," the prisoner replied. "But you've got to do it," I said. "Do you know what they do to people who don't Chu Hoi? They shoot them. Then I will be dead. I expect to die anyway, fighting for my cause, the freedom of my country, Vietnam." "My friend, you've put me in a very bad position. I like you. I respect you as a warrior. I know we're not going to convert you, but I do not want to see you get blown away. So do me one favor. Lie. Chu Hoi. I'll see if you can come back to my unit." "No. I believe in my cause," he said, and began pointing to his mangled leg and his many other raggedly healed wounds. "I believed in it through all of these. I will never surrender. I will fight until I'm dead. If they ask me to Chu Hoi, I will spit in their faces." I thought of Duk, one of my Tiger Scouts, an ex-VC company commander. Now he was my main advisor, who had Chu Hoi'd because as a South Vietnamese nationalist, he'd become convinced that the communists from the north were just using his people, that what they really planned to do was gobble up all of Vietnam for themselves. Who was wiser, I wondered? Duk, or the prisoner before me now? Who was right? And then I realized it didn't matter, because I knew that if the Viet Cong was composed of soldiers such as the VC lieutenant with the gouged-out leg, then right, wrong, wise, or simply gullible, they would prevail. Unless we could duplicate their will and dedication, all the cannons, all the helicopters, all the high technology we could invent and employ, enough even to send men to the moon, would never beat them. Since I couldn't get the guy to Chu Hoi, I turned to Plan B, which meant organizing for him to be flown back to Saigon to be turned over to an American POW camp. That way, not only would he be spared Arvin's final solution and the bamboo splinters under the fingernails, tiger cages, and electric shocks along the way, but he would not have to Chu Hoi, and he would be allowed to live. And though I never saw him again, I have little doubt that he did. Throughout this latter stage of my tour, I couldn't have asked for a better brigade commander than John Hayes, who supported the hardcore in all the things I felt were necessary to keep the battalion in fighting shape. He knew I sneaked each of the companies back to Dong Tam for regular 2 to 3 day wind-downs and training, so did Assistant Division Commander Brigadier General Frank Gunn, but they kept it from General Ewell and his statistic-crazy Chief of Staff, both of whom actively frowned on anything that brought down Paddy strength, which might in turn bring down the division's overall all-important body count. Hayes knew as well that I sent hardcore company commanders to train with the Australians, as I had done with the young first of the 327th leaders, so that they could pick up the skills of those well-trained and careful jungle fighters. Professionally, Hayes and I were of one mind, which invariably saved a lot of time, not to mention preventing frayed nerves, but it also led to a keen competitive spirit between us, not unlike Hank Emerson and I shared in the first of the 101st. Fortunately, Hayes and I were also very good friends, which took the edge off some of the one-upsmanship games we played. John, for example, had a thing about snakes. He loved them. He kept a boa constrictor in his quarters, and always had some new variety around as well to show off to his friends. I, too, had a thing about snakes. I hated them. If the truth be known, they were about the only thing in the world I was truly and consistently afraid of. So John used them to try to get under my skin. One time he radioed me from his chopper that he was coming into danger and wanted me to meet him at the helipad. When I did, he said he'd bought me a present at the PX, which I thought was a really nice thing to do, and handed me a bag. But when I opened it up, inside I found a live cobra. With no mongoose in sight, without even thinking, I flung the bag and contents into the air, snapped my .38 out of the spring holster under my arm, and put 6 slugs through that snake before it splashed down onto the water-filled bomb crater nearby. "You killed the little darling," John cried. "And I'll do it again if you bring any more of those things around here," I replied gruffly, reholstering my still-smoking pistol. I didn't get him back for that one until 2 years later, just before I left Vietnam, when he took me for a farewell lunch at the Mekong Floating Restaurant in Saigon. As we walked down the gangplank leading into the place, I asked him what he was doing wearing a pistol. "You don't need a sidearm here in Saigon," I exclaimed, and grabbed Hayes's Luger right out of his holster and tossed it into the canal. Hayes was aghast. A Luger was not just a sidearm, it was the ultimate sidearm, and John was extremely proud of his. He immediately flagged down a little kid and paid him to retrieve the Luger from the water. The kid did, and all was well that ended well. But more important, I evened the score. At this point in the war, most of the VC activity had gone back to hit-and-run small unit stuff. Although the real reason for this was to evade our firepower, it allowed the American command to form the mistaken impression that the enemy was down and on his way out. The truth was, despite the efforts of the accelerated pacification campaign, the latest hype, which according to the U.S. command in March of 69, showed 79.2% of the South Vietnamese population living under relatively secure non-communist control, the pacification hold was really only as strong and as long as the light of day. Generally speaking, the VC still owned 100% of the night, at least in the Delta. When I got hit on the 25th of March, I'd been just about to launch an attack on an area not far from danger that was seeing a tremendous amount of VC traffic. At first, I thought it was just a way station, but the more I watched, the more I felt a large enemy force was using it as a base camp. Why not? Each day we operated far and wide throughout our huge AO looking for main force units, and very seldom ventured into the relatively secure areas right on our doorstep at FSB danger. wasn't the safest place for a crook to hide on top of the police station. But when I got hit, my hunches had to go on the back burner. I told Mergner, who more and more was finding himself the battalion CO, XO, and S3, I didn't want anyone to go in there. I'd been watching the area for too long, and I knew the time was not yet ripe. I told Hayes the same thing when he came to visit me in the hospital at Long Bin. It's not ready yet. I'm letting it cook, so don't touch it. But, as Hayes later admitted, he couldn't resist. In the interests of one-upsmanship, after all, he knew there were VC in there, too, and the possibility existed for a big victory and a chance to shove it amicably up my nose, he launched a 1st Brigade attack on my target, and the whole thing backfired. First of all, he went in with 3 complete battalions, an overkill tactic that surprised me, given Hayes's undeniably guerrilla mind. Second, part of the air mobile assault went off prematurely, not Hayes's fault, which would have tipped his hand for sure if, third, John hadn't used Arvin troops as part of the plan. In my judgment, that was Hayes's biggest weakness in general, trusting the Vietnamese, and about the only place we disagreed about anything. I was convinced that Arvin was infiltrated from top to bottom with VC, and as far as I was concerned, giving them a piece of the plan was about the same as giving the complete operations order to the enemy. In any case, the net result of the operation was zero. The VC had cleared out. I was so pissed off I could barely talk to Hayes, commanding officer or not. "That was a rotten goddamn thing to do," I told him. "That's treachery, John Hayes." But when I got out of the hospital and back to the hardcore, and the intelligence profile on the area started developing again, the same activity, the same movement of people and supplies, I lost my anger and called on my guerrilla's patience to tide me over, and for almost 6 weeks, I waited. Life did not stop throughout this period, of course. While the battalion had no big battles, the men continued to rack up a body count daily over all our AO, an ambush netting 6 VC here, the snipers getting 8 there, eagle flights scarfing up another dozen somewhere else. On the 3rd of May, a platoon in Clark's Dagger Company ambushed a couple of sampans, killing 4 VC and capturing several weapons not far from my pet target area. When a couple of enemy troops got away across the canal, the platoon leader, Lieutenant Dave Crittenden, grabbed a few of his men and dashed across as well in hot pursuit. Unaware that they were virtually walking into the headquarters of the 261A battalion, Crittenden's force came under fire from a well-defended VC bunker. Crittenden destroyed the bunker and in the subsequent search came away with vital enemy documents, including the 261A's order of battle and attack plans. It was a true windfall, giving focus to the picture my intelligence was piecing together and shape to the enemy's intention. Among the documents was an attack plan against a nearby regional forces camp. If the VC were going for an RF camp, their objective was obviously not military. Instead, it was psychological and targeted at the local villagers. That is, if an RF company could be destroyed under the nose of a U.S. battalion, how secure was the average peasant? Fortunately for us, the attack plan came complete with the locations of all the 261A company's assembly areas, so as I watched enemy activity heat up on my profile, I knew we were one up on our foe whenever they decided to launch. Our target was perishable, but not so perishable that it was appropriate to bombard the VC positions with artillery or TAC air immediately, or grab every chopper I could find for a hasty air mobile assault. If I intended to get a complete harvest of these jokers, the only way to do it was to out-gee them, and for the moment, I was content reinforcing the RF camp with a U.S. rifle platoon and 2 M41 dusters, a full-track vehicle kind of a cross between a light tank and a Korean vintage Quad 50 designed for anti-aircraft but used in Vietnam in a direct support role, with twin 40mm cannons. After that, I was prepared to wait. By the 21st of May, the enemy activity we'd been monitoring was at frenzy level. There was no question that their attack on the RF camp was imminent, and time for us to make our move. I got my companies in the field, turned around, all tasked to move at dark by stealth toward the objective area to set up ambushes along all the enemy's probable withdrawal routes. Meanwhile, still in daylight, we made false helicopter insertions, the same as real helicopter insertions, only no one got out of the birds, and upon lifting off, the doors were closed and the troops lay down on the floor, along these same routes, to make the VC think twice in case they got wind of our plan and had a mind to bug out. When dark came, more forces left danger bound for other critical ambush positions, and by 0600 22 May, the stage was set. At 0700, Battle Company conducted an air mobile assault into the heart of the VC encampment. Their job was not to get decisively engaged, but simply to act as a beater. It proved one easy mission, for the VC, who only stood and fought when there was nowhere to go, immediately ran away through what looked like an easy escape route. Their only problem was that we had chosen that route for them. At the end of it and every other escape route they tried, the hardcore had an ambush ready and waiting. The scene on the ground was mass panic among the VC. From the air, it was like watching a game of pinball. Forced out into the open by U.S. airstrikes, artillery, and gunship fire, Charlie bounced off one ambush right into the next, recoiling from one blocked escape route only to hit another, and then yet another as he tried frantically to get away, each time leaving 7 or 9 dead behind. Besides swooping down and picking up each of my company commanders during the fight to let them see the scene from the air before the VC hit their units, which was very effective in helping them plan their next moves, even if it did result in a couple of serious-ass chewings from John Hayes, which I yes-sirred, all I did during the battle was sit in my chopper and call down to the leaders when the time came. "Heads up, Clark, they're coming your way, let them have it," followed by, "All right, DeRoos, they'll be in your position in about 20 minutes," as I watched the VC reel back from Clark's people and dash onto their next avenue of escape. It was the most satisfying operation of my career. It was the way I'd instinctively wanted to fight Operation Gibraltar 4 years before. 4 years later, I knew it was how the war should be fought. Synthesizing guerrilla tactics with our enormous firepower, we'd beaten them at their own game. We'd used their book of tricks to fight them on the ground and at the time that was to our advantage. The VC could not be destroyed by conventional tactics employed by the average U.S. battalion in Vietnam. Only guerrilla tactics augmented by U.S. firepower and our tremendous air mobility when required could defeat the enemy at a low cost in men and material. In this battle, for example, when the VC realized they were trapped, many resorted to hiding in bunkers. But there, they were only further pummeled by the 7 airstrikes, 500 rounds of artillery, and wall-to-wall chopper, minigun, and rocket fire we laid on them, until they got up and fled to the ambushes or went to ground until dark, when they could try to steal away. In the latter case, they had no better luck. At the end of the day, when the rest of the battalion vacated the battlefield, Gordy DeRoos's C Company went into a hide position, after a false helicopter pickup, to police up any stragglers, and their nighttime ambushes added 17 to the final tally of 113 enemy dead. In exchange for that number, the hardcore took exactly 4 casualties, all just slightly wounded. The next day, Louis B. Mayer would have been impressed with the number of stars we had visit us at FSB Danger. The deputy Commus Mac V, the USARV CG, who incredibly had actually radioed me during the battle the day before and ordered me to meet him at Danger immediately to brief him on the ongoing fight, the 2 FFV CG, the Division CG, and his ADCs. All were there to congratulate us on our job well done. And it was a job well done, like a graduation exercise for the 4th of the 39th after being transformed from a hard luck battalion into the hard core. After months of becoming more and more skillful and sophisticated in fighting Charlie, after taking his initiative away and chasing his sweet ass ragged around the province, now he was reacting to us, and so busy doing it there was no time to overrun district and province outposts or to intimidate the people. In our corner of the Delta, that birthplace of the Viet Cong and their longest and strongest of strongholds, We were cleaning their clocks. During the months I commanded the 4th of the 39th, our body count figures were more than 2,500 VCKIA in exchange for 25 battalion lives. 100 to 1. Even with the heavy rate of inflation taken into account, these were damn good numbers. And if such numbers could have been obtained within other free world forces fighting in Vietnam as well, the cost of the conflict could have been brought down to a level acceptable to allow us to fight a protracted war. And if we could have fought a protracted war, then ultimately the VC could have been forced to the very limits of Dupuy's much-vaunted but heretofore impossible-to-achieve threshold of pain. And in this way, the war could have been won, at least from a military standpoint. And yet, no one tried to copy us. The hardcore had come up with a brand new, albeit 4,000-year-old, low-cost way to fight the war. And yet not one of those 14 stars patting us on the backs on 23 May 1969 asked, "How'd you do it?" or suggested, "Let's get this Hackworth and a few people from his outfit to go around and train everyone." Even General Abrams said that all his battalions should fight like the 4th of the 39th, but no effort was made to make sure they did. I wrote a couple of articles for military publications in the next 2 years explaining our tactics and describing our fights, and while there seemed to be widespread agreement on the principles, no one seemed willing or able to try them out. So in the end, yet again, there were no lessons learned, and the same mistakes were allowed to be made day after day after day. If that was not disappointment enough, worse yet was the fact that after only 4.5 months in command, I was about to lose the battalion. The problem was that I'd been hit 4 times since February, and after the last one, General Abrams himself had stepped in and said, "Enough's enough," that I was too great an asset, and if I got wasted, it would be a great psychological victory for the VC. All my protests on the subject fell on deaf ears, but the part that disgusted me most was that it was really my own damn fault. I could have prevented Abrams even knowing about the last wound. I'd gotten it on one of my personal hunting expeditions. I'd just blown up 2 VC and a sampan with my M79 when our loach took a number of hits, shrapnel from which got me in the leg just a few inches below the wound I'd taken in late March. It was the kind of thing I definitely would have been evacuated for, but I was afraid I'd lose my command. So I thought of my VC friend with the huge hole in his leg, whose many wounds had healed very well unattended, and went to the battalion aid station. I told Windsor I didn't want to be evacuated and was leaving it to him to pull the shrapnel out. He probed around, feeling but not quite being able to reach it, until the pain for me was just too great, and I told him to forget it. So he just pumped me with penicillin and wrapped up the leg. I swore him to secrecy, and over time I healed up just fine. No one noticed anyway because I was still limping from the last wound, and that might have been the end of it, except I really wanted that Purple Heart. To a warrior, it was the only award that meant anything, particularly since the rest had become so completely degraded, and it was my 8th one. I was proud of that, and I wanted it on my record. So I asked Merdner to see if he could slip the paperwork through. He warned me that because I was a light colonel, it would go directly to Commus MacV, and he felt sure I'd lose the battalion. I insisted, however, betting that the clerks would never notice. As usual, Merdner was right. I was told I could have any assignment I wanted in the theater commensurate with my grade, as long as it wasn't in a direct combat role. I elected to go with General Timothy, who had recently called to ask if I wanted to be his G3 advisor up at 2 Corps headquarters at Pleiku. Besides being an essential part of my education for Latin America in the 80s, I thought it was time I learned about the advisory side of the war, and with Nixon and Kissinger now talking about turning the conflict over to the Vietnamese, I was sure my services could be of some use in an advisory role. In the process, maybe I'd even be able to answer the $64,000 question and find out why the little buggers from the South wouldn't fight. In any event, it was better than the job I would have had in August, G3 of the 9th Division, had I not been pulled from the battalion prematurely. In general terms, the three of a division was a plum assignment, but in this case, I could think of nothing worse. Defying all logic, given that the Delta was where a third of the South Vietnamese population lived, where most of the VC were, where most of the fighting was taking place these days, and the 9th was doing the bulk of it, the 9th Division was about to be the first unit pulled out of Vietnam. This did not even address the tactical absurdity of having the 9th Division in the Delta in the first place. The Marine Corps was the Defense Department's amphibious arm, yet throughout this period, when the Army was stumbling and splashing like ducks through the waterways of the Mekong Delta, the Marines, configured, trained, and equipped as amphibious shock troops, perfect for Delta combat, were fighting an infantry foot-slogging war up in I Corps, the most rugged terrain in Vietnam. As G3, I would have been part of the transition team whose job it would be to turn these combat soldiers fresh off the battlefield into peacetime shoeshiners in Hawaii. Not exactly my style. Because I knew the division was soon going home, it was possible to leave the 4th of the 39th without feeling too badly about it. Harris Hollis, the division commander, a tanker who'd replaced Ewell, bade me goodbye at my exit interview by suggesting that I had a death wish. It was a rumor he'd heard, and was it true? I assured him if I'd had any such thing, I would have been able to bring it to fruition long before now, a response that seemed to satisfy his impolite soul. The hardcore battalion proved to me everything I'd ruminated on throughout the 2 years that went before, all those ideas and theories on how to fight the G. If there was satisfaction in it, there was much less in the fact that my success didn't make a dent in the way the war was prosecuted. Ironically, what did was the debacle of Hamburger Hill, where Screaming Eagle C.G. Melvin Zeiss ordered 11 assaults up an extremely well-fortified, totally useless piece of real estate, as if he thought he was in Korea or storming Kraut positions at Normandy. Almost 400 American dead or wounded later, the 101 unit was king of the mountain, but within a week the objective was abandoned. The ensuing horrified uproar among the American people and in Washington made sure Hamburger Hill was the last huge and costly battle fought by American troops in Vietnam. So I guess if no one learned how to fight the war from me and the men of the hardcore, at least from General Zeiss, they finally learned how not to. But we were already 4 years into the war, and there were almost four more to go. 20. Born to Lose. Communist insurgents cannot be handled effectively by large conventional military forces. Our assistance to Arvin has resolved around the development of a large conventional force, with the dual purpose of protecting South Vietnam from a conventional attack by North Vietnam, while at the same time serving as an instrument in the counterinsurgency program. I think it is quite obvious to all who have looked at the situation that Arvin carries within it a number of breaks in its effective use in counterinsurgency. These include, 1, the organization and training trend to challenge the thoughts and reactions of its senior commanders toward conventional rather than guerrilla tactics, 2, the various layers of command from corps through division to regiment to battalion and finally to company, tend to make it extremely slow in reacting to Viet Cong small unit activities and overly cautious in striking out at the Viet Cong in an offensive role. Memo from David G. Ness, Deputy Chief of Mission, Vietnam, to Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge, 10 March 1964. John Hayes had a neat safe house in Saigon, which he gave me to wind down in for a few days before I headed north to Pleiku. Mi Lin, my lovely longtime Vietnamese pal, and I were having a fine old time there when we were interrupted by a phone call from Carl Beach, one-time XO of Company A, 2nd of the 502nd, who, in Ronnie Brown's absence, had skippered his unit during the first of the 101st's first night's action at Doc To 3 years before. Now Carl was aide-de-camp to General Ewell, who'd gone from the 9th Division up to 2 Field Force as CG, and he was calling to tell me Ewell had a job for me. "You've got to be kidding," I said. He's the last person I'd ever work for again. Well, I can't tell him that, sir, Carl replied. I'll pick you up at General Abrams' chopper pad tonight at 17:30. General Ewell would like you to have dinner with him. Ewell's gleaming chopper touched down on time that evening as I dutifully waited at Commuse MacV Abrams's MacV-1 helicopter pad. I was not going to work for that man, but I knew it wasn't in my best interests to ignore his invitation to dinner. It was obviously very serious. What with Ewell's own bird and personal aide-de-camp as escort officer, I was getting the full treatment. The second FFV General's mess was the most lavish I'd ever seen. The division messes at the 1st Air Cav and the Big Red One were like Salvation Army soup kitchens by comparison. Ewell certainly had hit the big time. As a 3-star, he had a very large general staff, all of whom, when I arrived, were in the middle of their cocktail hour, mingling with martinis, imperfectly starched jungle fatigues, and camouflage scarves, a million miles away from the War of the Grunt, which ran along unabated just beyond the berm of Long Bin's enormous base camp. I sat next to General Ewell at dinner. Throughout the meal, he treated me like a long-lost friend, and somewhere in the middle of it, he made his pitch. Hack, I want you in my G3 section. I'm going to set up a team to do after-action interviewing of the type Slam Marshall does, and I want you to run it. Sir, I'm going to play coup to work for General Timothy. That's a dead-end assignment, and you know it. I'm not going there to advance my career. You know, Colonel, Ewell pressed, I can pick up the telephone and get you assigned to my shop whether you like it or not. No, you can't, General. General Abrams said I could go anywhere in Vietnam I wanted, as long as it wasn't a direct combat assignment. I chose play coup, and that's where I'm going. The meal ended in a stalemate. Afterwards, Ewell invited me back to his quarters, as if in a private tete-a-tete I'd give ground I'd refused to in the very public mess. Hack, I really want you here, he urged. Sir, I would much prefer to work for General Timothy than for you. I do not want to be part of your command. Whatever you say, I'm not coming. There was no point in telling him it was a question of heart, because I didn't think he'd understand. In fact, he got the message loud and clear. Just how loud and clear I didn't learn until later, though, when I was picked up below the zone for bird colonel, and my name was nominated through USRV as being available for a brigade command. General Ewell actually went out of his way to write me a letter telling me we reap the harvest from the seeds we sow, and that when my name had come up in his command, he'd said I was unacceptable. General Zeiss, who was now a 3-star as well and ran the U.S. units in I Corps, had a long memory too. He'd not forgotten that I'd refused to go back to the 101st with him as G3, a move I still had no regrets over, except that maybe I could have prevented the disaster on Hamburger Hill. But in tandem with the Ewell situation, what this meant was that my big mouth and stubbornness had cost me the chance to command a brigade in combat in Vietnam. Still, at the time I left Ewell, I had the impression he was going to get me assigned to his headquarters come hell or high water. In the morning, I called Timothy to ask him to make sure Abrams knew I wanted to go with him, and then hot-footed it up to play coup still 3 or 4 days early, just to be on the safe side. There, I took my place among the thousands of U.S. advisors all over Vietnam who were tasked with the difficult job of turning the war back to the Vietnamese. How prescient Colonel, later Brigadier General Ted Metaxas's fear had been, expressed as a warning as early as his advisory days in 1962 of the war becoming Americanized. It had indeed become that over the last 4 years, so much so that now, from President Nixon down through the multi-layered American command, the act of Vietnamizing it was as deathly serious as it was basically absurd. In the months ahead, I would also find it was coming much too late. The 6 months I spent at II Corps were noteworthy only in that they were a complete waste of time. My job was to assist Arvin's II Corps in the area of operations and training through my rapport, the magic word in the advisory effort, with my 2-core G3 counterpart, Colonel Bin, and the 40 U.S. personnel in my G3 advisory shop, each of whom had his own Arvin counterpart to advise in some G3 area, be it air, artillery, signal, chemical, operations, training, plans, etc. But very little was actually accomplished. For one thing, at core level, we were too remote from the action to make much difference. For another, we on the advisory team were so inordinately busy shuffling paper and managing ourselves that many times the advisory part felt almost like an afterthought. More than half my time was spent writing reports that were little more than collations of the written reports coming up from the battalions. As I wrote to my brother after 3 months in the job, "Busy as hell moving rolls of red tape. This advisory duty is one big reporting task. Everyone is interested in how Arvin is doing, but advisors cannot assist because they are too busy writing reports." Most of the other half of my time was spent on matters dealing strictly with the Americans in my section, personnel problems, rotation, and the like. And in my subsequent advisory assignments, the amount of time required in this area only increased. It was easy to believe the experience related to me by one aid advisor I knew who'd worked in the same province from 1964 to 1968 and watched the advisor numbers therein swell from 12 people to some 200. Far more good was accomplished with the first dozen men, this aid guy said, than ever was with the next 188. On the other hand, whatever the advisory effort's bureaucratic hurdles did to impede a concentrated, effective push toward Vietnamization, at Pleiku, I concluded pretty quickly that the South Vietnamese at core level did not particularly care about Vietnamizing the war, much less about our advice to that end. The main reason for this, as far as I could guess, was that they really didn't think the Americans were going to leave. Over the past 4 years, the U.S. had fought the big unit war for the Vietnamese and allowed them to sit back in a passive defensive role, guarding towns, defending fire support bases, and, on paper at least, securing the people under the guise of pacification. While we'd built our own empires in Vietnam, those mammoth U.S. base camps and overstaffed American advisory HQs, we'd allowed the Viets to grow fat and complacent and to turn the war into a business venture. We'd even allowed them to become the best VC recruiters in the country by not stopping them from acting out the role of occupier, raping women, stealing livestock and rice, rather than protector of the people. Over the past 4 years, few Americans had pushed Arvin to perform, and few had pushed them to train. The Viets had gotten used to the musical chairs game of second string and or unqualified advisors, artillerymen, tankers, air defense, and military intelligence personnel, rotating through infantry battalion and regimental advisory slots one after another, all with bright ideas that, after 3 or 4 advisors, the Viets had learned how to stall until the advisor inevitably went on to the new job and the Viets could maintain the status quo. The Americans had never put their foot down before, and MacV's sudden tough talk now was so antithetical to the blank check attitude of the last 14 years of advisory assistance that for many of the Viets, it didn't even register. My counterpart, for example, was a shrewd entrepreneur who owned houses all over South Vietnam, which he rented to the Americans at exorbitant prices. Wherever we went, to Hue, Nha Trang, Quy Nhon, wherever, Colonel Bin owned a house. He'd say, "Oh, I bought this one 2 years ago, or 5 years ago, or 6 months ago." And in each one, I found the same permanent fixtures. 2 Rangers from 2nd Corps 22nd Ranger Battalion. "I borrow soldiers, and they guard my houses," Bin would explain, smiling brightly, leaving me not just to wonder what kind of IOUs this Corps G3 must have had over the 22nd Rangers Battalion commander that he could usurp perhaps 20 of his men to secure his real estate empire, but also to marvel at the fact that it truly did not occur or matter to Bin that those Rangers might have a more critical role to play in the ever-Vietnamizing war effort and beyond. The 2 Corps G2 was another character, who had a tendency to ignore any and all intelligence his counterpart, my good friend Colonel Wyatt Jim Mitchell, passed on to him. Much of this information came through radio intercepts and other high-tech means, and it was accurate, often red-hot stuff. But this guy went out of his way to avoid anything that could possibly involve fighting or pursuing the enemy. It was not unusual at this time for an American advisor to discuss a planned operation with his Viet counterpart in exceptional depth, making sure the latter understood exactly where it was to happen, when it was to happen, how it was to happen, and why, only to turn around and find the operation had been killed. No reasons given, it was just killed. In Two Corps, we also had a special problem with the stars. The Vietnamese Two Corps commander, Lieutenant General Lu Lan, who, like most of the Viet Corps commanders, generally acted more like a feudal baron in medieval Europe than a tactical leader, did nothing without first consulting his astrologer, a ritual, it might be added, that would be taken up and practiced in the White House throughout most of the 1980s. On one occasion, the general refused to conduct an operation despite reliable intelligence that it was a fat, soft target because his astrologer told him he'd have bad fortune if he ran such a mission during that particular period. There was no point in arguing with him. I recommended a B-52 arclight strike instead. The way I looked at it was the astrologer was probably VC. Why not? Hitler's was a British agent, and we probably got more kills with the B-52s than we would have had with Arvin's typical search and avoid the enemy anyway. This was not being harsh. Over 1 3-month period at the weekly review and forecast briefings for 2nd FFVCG and 2 Corps Senior Advisor Lieutenant General Charles Corcoran, the total result I had to report from 1,800 Arvin ambushes was 6 dead Viet Cong. On one occasion, when I was able to say that one of our Arvin units had engaged an enemy unit and actually cleaned them up with a body count of 22 with weapons, General Corcoran had been damn near elated. "It's reports like these," he said, "that help a fellow get through the day." The tremendous shortcomings of Arvin, which Vietnamization was suddenly highlighting, was nothing that hadn't been identified years before. The big difference was that the last time around, the Pentagon and the White House had had the option of using U.S. ground troops to keep Arvin from being swallowed up, an option now of steadily decreasing availability. David G. Ness, who served as deputy to Ambassador Lodge in 1963-64, was one who had warned early of the likelihood of the eventual disintegration of Arvin as a fighting force, but his bleak assessment and realistic suggestions regarding the war were considered nothing short of heretical by Generals Harkins and Taylor, and he was removed from his post the minute Taylor replaced Lodge as ambassador. 5 years later, however, little in Ness's accurate assessment had changed, and this fact alone made the outcome of the first major test of Vietnamization, the Battle of Ben Het, fought in the highlands of Two Corps in May through June 1969, as predictable as it was a complete mess. Not unlike Tu Morong, Ben Het was a CIDG outpost that came under enemy siege. Only this time, the Allied troops coming to the rescue were all Vietnamese, with the U.S. providing only support, air, artillery, and choppers, and limited engineer assistance. The operation was doomed from the start, because Arvin in Two Corps was not properly trained, motivated, or led for success. One of the major problems was that most of the soldiers in the regular Arvin units up there were city boys. They were homesick, they hated and feared the highlands, and considered assignment there the worst of all possible hardship duties. Their junior officers felt the same way, and did little or nothing to raise morale or foster the will to win. In addition, the heavily forested highlands terrain was not conducive to the conventional infantry tactics the troops' superiors and advisors had been calling on them to use since 1956. While Arvin stumbled along, trying to maneuver in impossibly thick brush, the enemy just set up ambushes that the South Vietnamese walked into again and again. In the highlands, Arvin was always reacting to the enemy's moves, and almost always coming out with a bloody nose. The result was units suffering heavy desertion rates, 20-30% per year, and those who remained behind fighting exactly as they might have been expected to, given their low morale and bad leadership in this hostile terrain. During the 7-week siege at Ben Het, the Arvan elements tasked to relieve the outpost moved toward their objective in half-hearted, torturously slow, battalion-size formation. They dragged their heels and called for U.S. air and artillery and bugged out in the face of any tough opposition, leaving the U.S. Army and engineers supporting them to fend for themselves on the battlefield. This desertion under fire created an explosive situation between U.S. and Arvan units because of the high U.S. casualties that resulted. General Timothy was at his very best during the battle, diffusing the acrimony between these allies and flying to Khantoum to push and prod the lethargic 24th Special Tactical Zone command structure into taking charge of the fight. The general also flew into Ben Het under heavy fire to set the example for the U.S. Special Forces-led Montagnards within. It was a gesture much appreciated by those tenacious fighters who held on despite the constant battering and repeated attacks on their outpost. In the end, the defenders at Ben Het did remain king of the mountain, and this result compelled MacVie to proclaim the battle as yet another great victory for our side, and proof for all the doubters that Vietnamization was working.